Welcome to WISO Weekend, your weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Up first in today's program, Montgomery County has some of the highest rates of infant mortality in the country. The problem affects African Americans at all income and education levels most often. WISO's Jess Mador introduces us to a Dayton Public Health campaign to address that.
At the Wesley Community Center in West Dayton, volunteers are gathering toys, games, and wrapped presents onto a long table. They're passing out pieces of frosted sheet cake for a baby shower.
Got chocolate or
a few dozen, mostly pregnant women, sit in groups at round tables. Organizer Angela Matlock says every one of them will be sent home with an armful of goodies.
Today they will be getting baskets. It's just like a real baby shower. The games, the food, all of that is included.
The Wesley Center holds these baby showers once a month. They're parties, but Executive Director Yvette Kelly Fields says they're also the tip of the spear for the center's public health campaign to reduce infant mortality.
Our goal is to make sure every pregnant woman gets connected to some kind of service, particularly anyone that can provide a visiting nurse after the birth of the baby.
West Dayton is the epicenter of Montgomery County's infant mortality crisis. African-American babies here die more than three times as often as white babies. The risk is highest in seven Dayton zip codes and one in Trotwood.
So that's what raises some alarm, that why is this particular spot in West Dayton seeing such a high infant mortality rate in comparison to all the rest of the county, in comparison to all the rest of the state, in comparison to all the rest of America?
Premature birth and low birth weight are the leading causes. Other contributing factors include poverty, limited access to healthy food, transportation, prenatal care, or education. But research finds statewide, African American women with at least 5 years of college are still more likely to deliver a preemie than even poor white women with only a high school degree or less. NPR recently reported racial discrimination and chronic stress may make early labor more likely. Kelly Field sees that phenomenon play out in West Dayton every day. She says the stress many African American women face is often compounded by a lack of support.
If I have a kid who has had a low birth rate, maybe has some health issues, I put my kid in daycare, they get sick, I can't go to work. Well, you know, how many days can you take off from a job before you get fired?
So the Wesley Center and other Montgomery County organizations want to fill that support gap by supporting high-risk women before and after their babies are born. Johnetta Webb is preparing for her second child.
I am 33 weeks pregnant, ready to bust, out of breath, tired.
She says she heard about the baby shower from a neighborhood friend and knew right away she wanted to come.
And I never knew that the community reached out to pregnant women like they do. And I was just interested to come and see what it was like, get more information.
Information about maternal and infant health. And since last year, the Wesley Center is giving any new moms who don't have a crib or bassinet for their newborns a free portable baby bed called a baby box.
Package of stuff. It comes with diapers, comes with some wipes, and then it comes with a covered little sheet and a little thin mattress.
Kelly Fields and Angela Matlock demonstrate how the box works. It's made of sturdy, pastel-colored cardboard with handles on the sides. It's designed to fit babies up to 6 months old. Kelly Fields says they help guarantee babies have a safe, dedicated place to sleep no matter where they are.
Like in a crib, you know, the baby gets wedged in between, hence getting smothered. Can't do that here. Take it anywhere. So if they got to go stay the night someplace, you're not trying to drag a pack and play or whatever, you just take this.
And afterwards, it can be used as a toy box.
Yeah.
The Safe Sleep program is similar to efforts underway across the state. The Ohio Department of Health reports they're having an impact. The number of sleep-related infant deaths statewide dropped more than 22% in 2016 compared to the year before. Kelly Field says the baby box program is working in West Dayton.
Being in the program almost guarantees success. We have not had no loss of life. Everybody so far has had a successful birth, and the children are still living and thriving.
To prove it, more data is needed. Kelly Field says the Wesley Center is collaborating with Montgomery County to collect more long-term data, the goal to expand the program to reach even more high-risk women and babies.
WISO's Jess Mador. Her report continues with a look at how state health officials are promoting visiting nurses to help reduce Ohio's infant mortality rate, which is much higher than the national rate, despite progress in preventing sleep-related infant deaths.
The reasons are complicated, but prematurity and low birth weight are the leading causes. Racial disparities and chronic stress also play a big role, says nurse Elaine Patrick.
Families who live underneath that federal poverty guideline, if we don't have the extra money for food, if I don't have transportation, how am I going to get to my doctor's appointment? And so just all those stressors, it tends to put them at a higher risk for premature labor.
Patrick is with the Help Me Grow Brighter Futures Visiting Nurse Program. It's designed to prevent infant mortality by supporting high-risk women during and after pregnancy. Patrick spends her days crisscrossing the Dayton area visiting women and their new babies at home. Today, she's checking in on 31-year-old mother of three, Betty Reynolds.
Hi!
A smiling face appears at the front door. It's a bubbly four-year-old named Amariah.
It's your birthday? Happy birthday!
Inside in the living room, Reynolds relaxes with her feet up on a small sofa. Three-month-old baby Jacqueline sleeps peacefully on her lap. Patrick has visited Reynolds every week or two since early in her pregnancy.
We've known each other for a while, so it's nice to talk to Betty about how her day's going, or if she's looking cute one day, I'm like, oh, Betty, you're looking cute. You know what I mean? So you build that relationship where she's got that trust with me, and I got that trust with her, that she could tell me, you know, whatever's on her mind.
There's a ton of research showing visiting nurse programs like this one are highly effective in reducing infant and maternal mortality, cutting the need for hospital visits, and boosting kids' readiness for school. Infant mortality is the death of a baby before their first birthday. And baby Jacqueline is especially high risk. She was born early at 37 weeks. Reynolds supports the family on a very low income. She and her other two daughters lived in a homeless shelter for a while during her pregnancy. Patrick unpacks her medical supplies on the living room floor. She takes out a baby scale.
So, first things first, let's weigh baby Jacqueline, okay? 11.7. That's awesome. So, and that's great because she's grown the way she's supposed to be growing.
Patrick visits up to 15 women a week. She monitors their health during pregnancy, and after birth, she visits to make sure mothers are recovering and babies are growing as they should.
So tell me how she's doing, like, eating now, like how many ounces and how she's tolerating it.
6 ounces, about an hour apart.
Over the last few months, Patrick and Reynolds have covered an alphabet soup of issues related to pregnancy and child development. Sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS, early literacy, and the importance of sticking to a schedule with kids.
I know, we're going to talk about books, okay?
Patrick encourages Reynolds to continue to read to the girls. Even just a few minutes a day makes a difference, she says.
Babies love to hear their mom's voices, you know?
And even if you're not reading, just talking to them, they catch on, they'll follow you.
It makes the brain connection. You know, she reads to her every day. By the time she's 5, 6 years old, she's like, it's normal. It's my routine.
Reynolds says it's important all of her girls enjoy reading. She's dedicated one corner of the small living room to a growing library of books.
Despite all these stressors, I think Betty's totally kicking some serious behind in raising these girls. Right, Betty?
Yes.
She's watched friends lose babies to infant mortality. Now she's become an advocate. She encourages all her girlfriends to learn about the dangers and take advantage of prenatal care during pregnancy.
When doctors ask you, do you want to be tested for certain things with your baby, like when you're in your first trimester, don't say no, say yes. So just do what you got to do. Just educate yourself.
All right. So in 2 weeks, you want to do the same time, 2 o'clock on the 4th? Okay. Bye, birthday girl. All right, I'll see you later, Mama. Bye. See ya.
Outside, Patrick says the program works because it fills that gap of emotional support that many moms just don't have.
We're an extra cheerleader. We're an extra person in their court that really just want to rally behind them and make sure that they make good choices with their children. So extra boost sometimes that they need in their day.
Patrick heads back to her car for her next visit. But she'll be back at the Reynolds house soon, and she'll continue to check up on baby Jacqueline until she celebrates her second birthday. WYSO, I'm Jess Mador.
I'm Jerry Kenny. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks for joining us. In 2016, Ohio became the 25th state to legalize medical marijuana. Since then, the state has been trying to implement the program, but that process hasn't been entirely smooth. Many local municipalities have been reluctant to get on board. WYSO's April Leslie spoke with Wright State University political science professor Dr. Lee Hanna about the state's progress and how a recent announcement by U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions may affect Ohio's burgeoning medical marijuana industry.
We've had a number of cities in the Miami Valley that have passed these medical marijuana moratoriums. Can you explain what these types of moratoriums will mean in practice and why so many cities are moving forward with them?
Yes. So the moratoriums give city councils and city leadership opportunities to review the policies, to put a halt on any, you know, zoning changes that would allow for medical marijuana dispensaries or cultivators to come into a community. And so what it won't do is, you know, for example, Huber Heights just made a decision to put a moratorium on a dispensary there. It will not affect individual people who live in Huber Heights from using medical marijuana under the state protections at this point. But what it might do is it might mean they have to drive out to Yellow Springs to get it, right? So that's what would change. But as far as individual users, the townships, they do not have jurisdiction over, you know, directing their police force to enforce or not. What they're essentially doing is, you know, making a judgment between, in some ways, there's a debate over public safety versus access and even money and revenue. And so those are some of the decisions that are being made.
Okay, let's switch gears a little bit. In the midst of all of this development in Ohio, Jeff Sessions comes out and says the Trump administration isn't going to follow these Obama-era directives that kind of paved the way for legalized marijuana in different states. Can you explain how this might affect the implementation of Ohio's medical marijuana program?
Yes. So what has been interesting about Sessions' announcement is that the general reaction, the response that we've seen from legislators in Colorado and California has been one of defiance. You know, you cannot step in. This is a violation of states' rights, et cetera. U.S. attorneys who've been interviewed, including U.S. attorneys in Ohio who've gone on record, have essentially said this has not changed much, that they still enforce marijuana when it comes to big-time traffickers. As long as people are kind of compliant with state laws, they are arguing that they're not really going to wade into that, that it won't be a major priority. What's been interesting is our elected leaders have been pretty silent on this. And so what you may see is that for communities that are enthusiastic about having medical marijuana in their community, you know, they may continue to kind of press on. But what could happen is state legislators who have been reluctant to, you know, really liberalize on marijuana laws may use this uncertainty, may use this new stance from the federal government as really cover to roll back some of these protections, or at least cover to really delay the implementation. And so that's where you may see that still local politics dominate. But that's still speculation, and a lot depends on the extent that Jeff Sessions really has the political capital to carry this out. You know, the truth is enforcing marijuana law still requires state resources. It cannot be, you know, fully manned by the federal government. So as long as our state says we're not enforcing it, we essentially can protect most patients, most producers, most doctors.
All right, Dr. Lee Hanna, that's all the questions I have for you today. Thanks for coming out.
Great. Thanks for having me.
That was WYSO's April Leslie speaking with Dr. Lee Hanna of Wright State University. You can find their full conversation online at WYSO.org. Today on Dayton Youth Radio, we have a story from the David H. Ponens Career Technology Center about being mean. Here's Youth Radio Project Coordinator Basim Blunt.
Sometimes you check the news and you realize you're right in the middle of it. That happened to Doriasia Smith. She saw stories about bullied teenagers and kids who killed themselves because of it. She thought about it and realized she was a bully. Here's her story.
My name is Doriasia Smith. I am now 17 years old. I am a senior, and I'm a varsity volleyball athlete. I was once a mean girl back in 7th grade. A mean girl is someone that picks on somebody else for no reason, just like bullying somebody. Uh-oh. Me and my crew were the mean girls at my school. To tell the truth, I kind of liked it. Me and my group of friends used to bully a girl named Danica. We didn't know anything about her besides what we saw at school, and that was she walked and talked funny. I felt popular, I had lots of friends, and it was funny at the time. Even though it was not nice, I really only bullied Danica because my friends were doing it. Kind of like peer pressure, because I felt like I had to do it to fit in with them. Peer pressure is not all that great, because you're not actually being yourself. You're being someone that other people want you to be. Hey, I didn't want them to turn on me when they were talking about Danica, because I sure didn't want to get talked about. I also needed friends, so yeah, I was going to try my hardest to fit in with them. I was basically a follower. I remember one thing that we did was really mean, was talk about her hair. We were sitting in class one day, and Danica was in the back of the room. She was sitting at her desk, running her fingers through her hair. Me and my mean girls went back there. One of the girls took her pencil and said, "You don't need this. You don't even know how to do your work with your dumb ass." The other girl began to say, "With your nasty hairstyle." I stood there and laughed with the rest. They all began to look at me like they wanted me to say something. So I went behind Danica and I slightly shoved the back of her head. And I said, "Dummy." We all began to walk away laughing. She started to cry. Danica never told on us. So one day, we tried to get her to start cussing. Basically, make her like one of us. Of course, we were the people talking smack to her. We just tried to teach her how to argue back so we could actually have competition. But again, all she did was walk away crying. In spring at school, it was lunchtime. I had lunch detention for talking back to my teacher. As I walked into lunch detention, I spotted Danica sitting down, so I decided to sit by her, thinking she would forget all the things that I did. Sadly, she didn't. When I sat down, she quietly stood up and moved away. I felt a little hurt because I knew exactly why she moved, so I tried to make things right. I then got up and moved over there to her. I said, "Danica, I'm sorry." All she did was roll her eyes. I began to say, "I'm really sorry. I know it was wrong of me and my friends to do that, and I apologize." She began to nod her head and smile a little. But she never did say she forgave me. Don't treat me so loud. Don't go mean, yeah. You love me, this man. For Dane Youth Radio at Ponens Career Technology Center, this is Doria J. Smith. See, your love's got me lost with nowhere to go, gone crazy, insane, and I don't even know. It's like ignorance comes and takes over the show, because I had it all together, but love stolen the flow, trying to figure out. That's a story called Mean Girls, written and produced by Doriasia Smith, a senior at Ponens Career Technology Center. There's a companion piece on Dayton Youth Radio that goes with this story about bullying. You can hear that on WYSL.org. Or on the iTunes podcast. Special thanks to Joanne Viscup, Jeff Crowell, and Katie Davis. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blunt.
Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Ohio Arts Council. See, your love's got me lost with nowhere to go, gone crazy, insane, and I don't even know. It's like ignorance comes and takes over the show, because I had it all together, but love stolen the flow, trying to figure out why you treating me this way. Living here with you's got me eating these mistakes, tired of my girls seeing me get played. No longer me, everything needs to be his way. Forgot about us, you forgot about we. It's not about love and it's not about me. Gotta go, because I ain't beating no games.
Worthless, although I still love you.
Opioids have been the subject of several of our Dayton Youth Radio stories. Dayton and Montgomery County are at the epicenter of the nation's fierce opioid epidemic. WISO reporters have covered the crisis over the last few years, and today we're going to introduce you to an upcoming series we'll be bringing you this spring. It's called Your Voice Ohio. Here once again, WISO's Jess Mador.
Your Voice Ohio is a grant-funded collaboration between WYSO and more than two dozen other radio, television, digital, and print news organizations. The idea is to help change the conversation around the opioid epidemic by putting more of an emphasis on solutions. The project was the brainchild of Pulitzer Prize-winning newspaper journalist Doug Oplinger. He's a 46-year veteran of the Akron Beacon Journal, and he joins me now. So, Doug, tell us more about how you got the idea for this project and what you're hoping to do.
I have to admit that this is an outgrowth of a lot of work that started back in 2012 when the Akron Beacon Journal was exploring the growing incivility in the country. We did that with the local faith community and university. And as we listened to people talk, they blamed the news media as the number one reason for the divisiveness in the country. And that stuck with me. And as we approached the 2016 election, we joined with several other news organizations to explore this idea and try to change the way we do our work, to lift the voices of the people in the state as opposed to being closely aligned with the politicians. So that created this Your Voice Ohio project. The project grew, and we decided that the opioid crisis is something that absolutely requires our attention and a change in the way we do business, because what we've been doing isn't helping solve this.
Well, as you know, many reporters around Dayton and the state, including here at WYSO, have been covering the opioid epidemic pretty closely. So can you tell us how this project will be different from some of the other storytelling we see every day on the radio and the television about the crisis?
You raise some great questions about the fact that we have been covering this aggressively for a number of years. And what's frustrating is that thousands of people die each year, 4,000 in Ohio, 1,000 in Southwest Ohio alone each year. Where is the public outcry in this? And as journalists, we live in these communities, and we're concerned that this is indicative of much more than overdoses or bad behavior. This is a medical issue. This is an issue that may have its roots in our economic crisis in Ohio. We've got to address this. And journalists are frustrated that people aren't joining in this conversation. So we're going to experiment. We're going to change the way that we do our work by sitting with people and exploring this idea with them, allowing them to watch us do our work, and most importantly, paying attention to what they need from us on a day-to-day basis so that they can find personal solutions and community solutions. Here is the key. We have been writing about crisis and gruesome stories for years. We are going to start writing about the hope that's out there, about people who are making a difference, and about people who are conquering this opioid dependency.
Events are a big component of this project. So what can we expect, and how can people in the community get involved?
One of the most exciting parts of this is that news organizations are setting aside their competitive instincts and sharing resources, sharing reporters and stories to provide better information more often. And we're going to co-sponsor community meetings where we're going to encourage everyone, whether or not you have some stake in this crisis, to come and allow us to hear your thinking. And from that, we will redesign our coverage. And our experience in the Youngstown-Warren area was that we came away pretty much surprised by the new things that we needed to be doing. So I would expect that if people come and share with us, they will see us react in new ways to what they said.
You've been listening to a conversation between WISO Managing Editor Jess Mador and Doug Opplinger from the Your Voice Ohio Project. To learn more about that project and how you can participate, visit us at WISO.org.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. For the first week of late winter and the second week of the frolicking fox moon and the first full week of the sun in Aquarius. Sometimes the arrival of late winter carries a great thaw. One day I went out to the river in the warmth of such a thaw. Cumulus clouds tumbled across the sky in gusts of the southwest wind, and the water of the river was shining with low, brisk waves of silvers and blues and grays. The oaks of the far bank were black against the bright sky. On hillsides of Osage trees, patches of their yellow wood glowed like the flush of expanding spring buds. And below the Osage, hardy green chickweed and wild onion and garlic mustard and henbit and hemlock lay akimbo across the melting snow. The river had flooded earlier in the week. Mounds and drifts of silt and sand followed the course of the flood along the paths. In the bottomland, the high water had uncovered foliage of buttercups and ragwort and sweet rockets. In the swamp, fat skunk cabbage curled above the mud, many plants open and blooming. Great white stalks of last May's angelica crunched under my feet as I picked my way across the wetland. The rivulets that passed through the grassy bogs were full and fast. I even saw small fingerlings swimming in one stream far from any pool for safe haven. I surprised a water strider in an eddy of a brook watercress and duckweed there. Climbing to the top of the ridge, I saw the river and its tributaries become paths of radiance. And sometimes, as I walked into a sudden patch of fog, the brilliant curves of life disappeared, the enclosure of the enveloping fog showing both the confinement and the freedom of the valley. There I lost my landmarks, but also my limits. There was no other side to the river, and like the end of the year before me, the opposite bank seemed infinitely distant. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the second week of late winter. In the meantime, walk in the thaws and in the promise of their season.
Poor Will's Almanac for 2018 is available from Amazon. And you can purchase my book, Home is the Prime Meridian, Essays on Time and Place and Spirit, from the same site. The collection contains a number of the selections heard on this radio segment.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WISO.org.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. Up next on WISO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.